You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Christine Davies, Reverend Christine Davies. I actually think this is the second ordained guest I've had on the show, and that's super fun for me. Our conversation is about the choices and the decisions that brought her to the career that she has today. So we talk about science, we talk about faith and spirituality, and I'm going to tell you that this conversation might go a slightly different direction than you might be expecting. Maybe not. It did surprise me a little bit, and you'll have to listen or watch to see for yourself. So with all of that, I'm going to stop yapping and let's get to the conversation. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Christine Davies, are you ready for a fun chat today?
Oh, I'm so excited to be here and talk with you.
I love that. I have two warm-up questions that I love. I start all of my conversations asking my guests what part of the world they call home. So where are you?
I am a Jersey girl, born and raised. I live in New Jersey in Hunterdon County.
Nice. Love that. All right. So Jersey girl, share something with us that you love about where you live.
Yeah, so where I live right now, I actually grew up in the suburbs of New Jersey in North Jersey. Now I live more in Central Jersey, and I live on a 34-acre hobby farm, and so was just out walking our goats, and we have chickens and beautiful hiking trails and trees, and so it's just such a lovely place to be able to come and decompress.
Love that. One of the earliest interviews I did on the show was about somebody who had a hobby farm, which is where I learned what that meant. 34 acres sounds to me like a lot to maintain.
It is a lot of work. There's a lot of weeds involved and a lot of overgrown bramble.
It's a lot of work. There you go. All right. Today you are a hospital chaplain. You're the first person who's a hospital chaplain that I've had the chance to talk to on the show. Uh-huh. And in this conversation, we're going to talk actually about some of the choices and experiences that got you there, how you ended up in that spot. Are you ready for that today?
I am, absolutely.
All right, I love that. So you shared with me on the intake form that you were planning to pursue a career in medicine and you worked as an EMT for a while. Share with us how long ago that was.
Oh, many, many years ago. So I was actually the youngest EMT in the state of New Jersey because I took my test right as I turned 16. So a lot of that was in high school and college where I started pre-med and thought that I was going to be really focused on medicine and working in the hospital. And my mom was a nurse, and so I think she was really pushing that dream along.
All right. So it was an early, early dream of being in the medical field. Okay. So what was it that attracted you to, your mom was a nurse, but what else was it that attracted you, you think, to the field of medicine?
Yeah, so I was a very precocious kid and very much into religion and going to this church that my family attended and really enjoyed being there. And from a young age, felt like there was a divine presence in my life and that my calling, so to speak, was to help the most people possible. And I thought, oh, the best way to do that is through medicine, is through, you know, becoming a doctor, which is why I'd gone through the EMT training. I love to just read the Merck Medical Manual for fun and, you know, play around with my stethoscope. Loved being in the hospital setting and, was pre-med in college. And the hope was actually to go to the Army because they would help pay for medical school and then work as a physician.
Okay, so just an early desire to help people and attracted to medicine for all the things that it was, specifically hospitals. That's very interesting. Okay, so one of the early shifts that happens in your path is that you get a diagnosis. Well, you can tell this, but you get a diagnosis, and this is obviously, nobody chooses a health diagnosis. This is something that happened in your life. Tell us about the diagnosis, and then let's talk a little bit about, you know, the struggle and the decisions as you adapted to what was then your new normal.
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with generalized epilepsy, and it took a while to get to that diagnosis. I was having all these headaches, things that looked like fainting spells. I went to doctor after doctor after doctor, and looking back, it would have been a very easy diagnosis to come up with, knowing what I know now, if they'd just done, you know, a simple test, which is an EEG. But I had so many healthcare practitioners tell me, "Oh, it's in your head," which it was, ironically, but not in the way that they were implying. And you know, so they sent me to therapy. I went to therapy, but. Which is fine, and I'm a big advocate of therapy and think everyone should do it. However, I was really missed, and I think a lot of it was because I was a young woman and not taken seriously. And so when I finally got the diagnosis, there was some relief, but there had been a lot of agita on my part leading up to it. I didn't trust these medical personnel that I had spent my time admiring, and I had them on such a pedestal, and then I had frequent hospitalizations as a result. And, you know, a group of doctors would come into my room and not even address me by name, but only, you know, my medical record number, and not, you know, talk to me and see how things are going with me. And then even after that, there was a little bit of relief with the diagnosis, but it did change my life pretty significantly, you know, having to surrender my license for a period of time. It was a lot of trial and error with many of the medications. And every time I changed a medication, I had to be hospitalized for a week. You know, I think at one point I gained 50 pounds, lost all my hair, just as side effects of the medication that I needed to treat my seizures. Then there were the seizures themselves, which, you know, I tell people 1 in 26 people have epilepsy or some sort of seizure disorder. And there's over 400 different types of seizures, so they can look different. Usually what we see on TV are like the grand mal or the tonic-clonic seizures.
Right, because so they changed the name of that.
And so when you see someone kind of on the floor, those are the most dramatic ones. I have had those. And those can be scary for other people to witness. I don't know, because I'm very much out of it when it happens, but my loved ones, you know, tell me after the fact. And then there's other ones that like an absence is more of just like a, you kind of look like you go blank a little bit for some people, or I might just have jerks here and there. So it really runs the gamut. So it took a while to get, you know, to the diagnosis, then to get to the right medications. And then it's always, you know, even, you know, decades later, it's always a struggle, even though I am, you know, very well medicated. I have fantastic doctors now, you know, but even going through pregnancy, for instance, it, you know, the seizures go up and down with that, and was hospitalized again with a pretty severe episode. So it's just always something that's kind of going on in the background and has prevented me from doing things. And in other ways, it hasn't prevented me, and I've still been able to do some of those things. But in the process of getting diagnosed, I just did not want to play this guessing game. That's what it felt like it was to me, to go into the field of medicine. It also helped that I took organic chemistry and hated it. So those two factors combined really helped to solidify me. But it was also because I realized that there were other ways to help people. And we had a new associate pastor at the church that my family was going to at the time. And she took me out to dinner just in the middle of all of this going on in between hospitalizations and just talked to me. And over like a plate of spaghetti was just asking me how I was coping with everything and how I was handling it. And I felt more renewal in that, you know, hour and a half period with her than I had after any of my doctor's appointments, any of my hospitalizations, any of my medicines. And so that's when I started realizing, oh, there's a different way that I can help people, both from the medical perspective and also the spiritual and emotional perspective.
So there's a lot in that story. So it's one of the things, it's a common theme for some of the conversations that I've had over the last several months on the show. Many people come and talk about the emotional part of pursuing a diagnosis, which takes time and isn't easy, and advocating for yourself or just sort of working through the medical system. And so that sounds like that was definitely a part of the process. There's been at least one other person who came in and talked about an epilepsy diagnosis for a child of theirs, because it is one of those weird things that we all know about. I don't think anybody doesn't know about epilepsy and seizure disorders. And yet, until you see it happen in front of you, or and if you have it in your family, you don't know. You don't know what it's going to look like.
Yeah,
or
it
you
can
can
be
think
very persnickety.
Very persnickety. You live with it. So I'm telling you something. I'm describing your own situation to you, which is obnoxious, and I apologize. Okay, so.
It brings joy to me to know that other people are also talking about it and having the conversation. And I think it's the type of thing, you know, we have come a long way in terms of how we can test for it, and it's made a lot easier. But you're right, there's so many roadblocks when it comes to resources. Yes. And even now I'm dealing with a health issue for my child, and I'm like, oh, I have, you know, I work in the hospital. Like, I should be able to figure this out more. And it is still very difficult to get answers sometimes.
Right. That is an unfortunate situation. All right. So you thought you were just fainting. I think that that's a really interesting thing to hear, that because it is one of the through lines of this show is the difference of, you know, the difference between knowing something and being an expert in something and living through it, because we do support each other differently. So the two things are very different, you know, so talking to somebody about having a seizure after reading it in a book or watching it on TV is very different probably than sharing the experience with somebody who has also gone through that process.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, you know, I would encourage your listeners, and it became true for me from the diagnosis, is learning to trust your own body. And I sometimes tell my patients this, like, you know your body better than anyone else. So if something feels off for you, you are the expert. You can consult exit and hopefully, you know, get to the bottom of things. But I have met with a lot of people that need that persistence, especially when there can be, you know, a fair amount of medical gaslighting going on at times.
Yes. And now you are a parent. And so I will say that one of the things that definitely happened for me in my life as an adult with kids is that as an adult with young children, you're advocating for them. And, you know, they are the expert in their own body, but they don't always have the words or the knowledge to explain what's happening. And I remember one of my kids was in sports, and she was trying to describe, you know, discomfort or pain. And I remember saying to the doctor, I was like, how am I supposed to know how much this hurt? You know, she doesn't know the words yet. I have knowledge, she doesn't, and she doesn't know yet what to do. And we laughed, and he was like, we do the best we can. We don't know, you know, we don't know.
It makes me think when I was a couple of years back, I was picking out my kids' clothes for the first day of school. I wanted them to look a little bit nicer. And my older one's like, no, I don't want to wear that. My body, my choice. I said, well, that's not quite, you know, how most people intend that phrase. But yes, you're right. What do you want to wear?
That is very funny. That kids, I love that. That's a very cute story. Okay, so part of this story, I think you began to share this, is that as a part of this process of going through the diagnosis and the frustration that you experienced with your own path through the medical community that you thought you wanted to be a part of, you turned to your spiritual roots. And I think that sometimes people use this word spiritual in a couple different ways. For you, this is a faith-based.
Yeah, so it may be helpful to describe that, because I talk a lot about the difference between religion and spirituality. And for some people, there's overlap. And for some people, they're two separate things. So religion, I think we're usually familiar. We're thinking about organized religion, faith communities, essentially a group of commonly held beliefs by a community, usually for the sake of divining and being learning more about God or the divine. And so spirituality, I think, is a little harder to define. The way that I like to define it is it's the way that we're feeling connected to ourselves, the way that we're feeling connected to others around us, and the way that we're feeling connected to the universe or transcendence, or for some people, if they believe in God, you know, that's when we're also talking about God in that realm. And so for some people, religion helps them connect in all three of those areas. And so religion can be a big part of their spirituality. So I would say for me, It's a part of it, but it's not all of it. And I also meet with a lot of people where religion is completely off the table, usually for good reason, especially when there's been a lot of toxicity in institutionalized religion and a lot of abuse. And what I try to help people see is they still have access to their spirituality if that's something that they want. They don't need to incorporate their religion. Sometimes we have to deconstruct that a little bit. But a lot of times people throw both away saying, oh no, I don't want a part of any of that. But really trying to help people see, no, you can access your own version of spirituality. And that can look different for different people.
I am so happy I asked that question, Christine, because I have talked to so many people just in my life as a human being, not as any kind of expert, who sometimes do really find themselves in a little bit of a struggle with that, as you described, or also just in people who are part of and prioritize a faith community, but they also find other spiritual things interesting and they're not sure if they go together.
Sometimes I like to compare it to self-care, because self-care can look different for all of us. You know, my husband's self-care is, you know, reading books about history and war. That is not my self-care, right? And spirituality can be the same way. You know, what feeds one person's spiritual life is not necessarily going to feed a different person's spiritual life. And it can also vary along different seasons of our lives.
So very good. So you say that part of the epilepsy journey turned you back to your spiritual roots. You mentioned that you grew up in an active church community. What? Tell us more about your roots and how this turned you back to that.
Yeah, so I grew up going to the local Presbyterian church. I definitely took to it more than the rest of my family. My sisters say like they haven't been into a church since my ordination and have no plans of going back. But I was really drawn to it. And I think a lot of what I was going through in the midst of trying to find the diagnosis and a little bit afterwards, I didn't know the term for it then, but there is a term called dark night of the soul.
Right.
And the idea of that, so you may have heard of it. Some people have are familiar with it originally from St. John of the Cross. And the concept, for those that aren't familiar, is you're kind of plunged into this period where you may feel disconnected from God. You don't know what's happening to you. It can feel very similar to a depression. However, it is separate from that. Sometimes they can go hand in hand, but this is kind of a spiritual phenomenon in and of itself. So it can start from an event. I see this a lot happening for people around grief and loss. That can kind of plunge them into it. For me, it was, I had been asking God, you know, what's going on with me? Like, and not getting an answer for so long, it really helped me to get into that space of wondering, of crying out, of wanting things to be different. And so I find most people that I talk to, and myself included, when we've gone through a spiritual dark night of the soul, we come out the other side different. You know, we, and this is probably true for a lot of the stories that you're talking about on here, right? Like when an event happens, it changes us. And so a spiritual event of that nature, I would say it made me even more connected to God, but it's through the wrestling that you become even more connected. And I've been through others in my life, and I think it usually brings about a changed perspective and some depth that maybe wasn't there before.
That is so great. So I do not think I knew the original source of that. I think that I've heard it mentioned in TV shows and movies, mm-hmm. is actually where it's sometimes a plot point where people are grappling with their like it may be, I mean, so I think that that's where I
heard. Yeah, it can be very cinematic. Very right. Dramatic.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of an exact example, but there are movies and TV shows where they talk about, you know, people pursuing divinity or ordination and things like that and struggling with it or walking away or all these things. So I think that that's where I heard of it. Not that that matters, but I appreciate that you knew. I really do. Okay, so at this point, you're leaning into your roots, but I think you may have also entertained or gone a little bit down the path of looking into becoming a therapist or even a social worker.
So I did that later. It took me a while to get to, so I went to, I did go to seminary as a result of feeling path was shifting.
Okay.
And then while I was at seminary, I also pursued a social work degree because while I felt like I was being led to do ministry, I didn't want to do ministry in a church. I didn't want to be preaching every week. And I thought, I don't know where that's going to leave me. And so I also pursued my social work degree and then was a counselor for a little while as a cognitive behavioral therapist in a community mental health center and discovered I really didn't enjoy it. And that led me into the field of chaplaincy. So there have been a couple of twists and turns that I can look back on in retrospect and realize, oh, okay, that was me, you know, figuring out what that bump was and really at every part in the way, having it be clarified a little bit more.
Yes. And when you were talking about grappling with the choice and the dark night of the soul, and you were saying with every round of making that decision, you come out a little different on the other side. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons I focus on asking people about what choices did you make. And you did make so many choices, even though when you look in the rearview mirror for your journey, it's easy to connect the dots to see how mm-hmm. they came to where you are. But in the moment, as you were doing this, it probably felt like these were forks in the road, one way or the other. Does that mm-hmm. seem like that's reasonable? Or what was your experience? I shouldn't decide for you. What was your experience? How did you feel?
I think that's accurate. In the moment, it did feel like this was a major pivot and that I couldn't go back, which is something I help people deal with now. I'm like, well, you can always try something and you can always go back. Yeah. If that new challenge or that new adventure is not what you had hoped it would be. And I think just in the moment trying to do the next thing. So knowing the next step, but not ultimately knowing what is that going to look like, you know, at the end of my life, at the end of my career. So I remember being in seminary, and seminary is a wild place for a lot of reasons. But it's there for 3 years. And that whole time, my consistent prayer was, okay, well, I'm here. I'm at seminary. Like I said, I would do this ministry thing, but I'm not feeling exactly what type of ministry thing I'm supposed to be doing. And my, classmates were all wanting to be pastors at churches or wanting to be academics. And that was not the path that I was interested in. So that's part of why I did the social work degree and got double the loans for maybe a backup plan in case that calling didn't make itself known to me.
So it's clear in this conversation that you're a planner, that you're a driven person, that you make backup plans in the things that you do, all of those things. This is how you find your way to being a hospital chaplain. How did you even how did you find out that even existed? Like, was it something you knew from being in the medical field, or where did you?
I didn't know it from being in the medical field. This is one of my, biggest areas of contention with my work is that very few people know what a chaplain is even. And we're not necessarily featured in, we were on Grey's Anatomy recently. I was told that
okay.
there was a chaplain finally after, 20 years of Grey's Anatomy, there was one on there. And so it, especially when I walk into patients' rooms, they often have no idea what a chaplain is. So I had to do an internship while I was in seminary, and I did an internship at a hospital and really loved it. But also thought, let me finish up the social work degree, situation first. And then, I quit my job as a therapist to go back to trying out the hospital chaplaincy degree. I will share with you this story. When I was working as a therapist, a lot of my clients were mandated by a drug court, so they had dual diagnoses, and they didn't necessarily want to come and talk to me and weren't so motivated. I was between me and jail, so I was maybe the lesser of the two. But I had to do a lot of the intake forms, which in that day and age were on paper. I had to bring my own pens with me. And it was 167 pages that we had to fill out. And
wow.
I remember on it was a lot. And I remember on page 38 at the very bottom, and we get into great detail about everything that's going on in a person's life. And there was one question at the bottom that said, are you religious/spiritual? yes or no, check one. And then if yes, there was one line where I could write whatever the client said. And I realized, I was like, I would get so excited by the time I got to that question that I wanted to spend all my time talking about it. And I would usually get upset if they're like, no, next question. And I was like, no, I want to hear more about that for you. And so that's really what helped me to see. I have to try out this chaplaincy thing to spend all my time talking about spirituality.
So I think that many people who have gone through graduate work for clinical psychotherapy are nodding along as they listen to this, because I know so many people who have done that work of the court-mandated therapy, because that's one of the things that, I mean, a lot of people who are in school end up doing that because it's there's an enormous amount of hours that need to be done to.
Absolutely. I got hired.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. No, that is, I think that they were, oh, yes, we've been there. And I don't think anybody would, I mean, listen, that nobody's going to be thrilled about that. All right. So I think this is really, really very interesting. I think the path you took and the choices you made and the clarity you have on the decisions and where it pointed you and gave you clarity is really interesting. This show is not actually a how-to kind of show, but I did come up with one question because you have a very interesting set of experience and skills in doing something that most modern people really struggle with, both as a counselor and as a chaplain. You are a person who is surrounded in your profession by really tough situations, emotional, stressful, you know, grief. You mentioned that you were doing the intake work with court-mandated substance misuse. And so the challenge that I think a lot of people find in that when they're in these high-stress jobs is protecting their own mental health and well-being in balance of that very tough job, right? You're working in a hospital with people who are going through people are not usually, well, the maternity ward, sometimes most people are celebrating, but otherwise, you know, and not even necessarily always there, but it can be a tough spot, illness, grief, stress. I wondered, and I'm totally sandbagging you on the spot with this question, would you be willing to share one of the ways that you try to maintain this balance for yourself in your own life?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a great question, and I'm especially mindful of it because now in my career, I run my department, and so I have other chaplains that are reporting to me, and I also do a lot of teaching, and so I'm teaching chaplaincy students. How do you not take this home with you? How do you continue to sustain yourself so that you can show up day after day? I am often at the worst moments of people's lives. And so one of the things that I think helps a lot is to remember I can't make it any better. There's nothing I can do to fix this situation. Maybe I can make it 1% easier for the family, even if it's helping them figure out where the bathrooms are or making sure that they have food or, you know, certainly talking with them and validating where they are, saying a prayer if that's what they would like me to do. So I like to really focus on what I can control in that situation, which is not much. It's just how I show up versus what I can't. But then really having to develop what I call soulful self-care. For me, that has looked like spiritual practices of moving to a hobby farm and tending okay. bees and, being consumed with the seasons and nature. That is one way I do it. Another way that I process is by honoring so many of the tender stories that I am bearing witness to, because they feel too precious for me to hoard to myself. And I think that there's so many beautiful lessons that can be had in what my patients have taught me over the years. So I do a lot of writing on Substack, and I'm constantly putting in patient vignettes. They're composites, so, you know, I'm changing all the details. They can't be identified. But the message is usually still there of, you know, how can we have this at the forefront of our mind, and really sometimes living with the end in sight. I get accused a lot of times of being rather morbid because I work with a lot of death, but I do think if we keep the fact that we are going to die one day in the forefront or maybe the back of our minds, that helps us live more fully with intention each day, and really make the most of this life. So I find that to be helpful.
I mean, that's the Stoic philosophy, right? The momentum.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Momentum mori.
Mori. Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty divisive among people. Like when you talk, if you talk casually with your friends through your lifetime, some people mm-hmm. do find it very much a tool for living in the present moment. And other people are like, no, that's terrible. I don't want to think about that. You know, so that is, I think that that's, those were some very good tips. And I think that it's, there's a lot of pressure for privacy and being careful of people's stories. And then there's also tremendous benefit for people who can be witnesses to share stories that many of us will go through, but we won't be prepared for them when we get there. Mm-hmm. And the one that I see over and over again is, you know, most of us are lucky if we outlive our parents. That's normal, and yet it's a really tough journey because even though we know it's going to happen, most of us are nowhere near ready for it when we get there. And there's probably thousands of those different stories that it's like, it's very important that where we can, and you know, that's one of the things that back in the olden days, that's what fairy tales were about, like the fables, the kids, we told these stories about these horrible things that can happen in a friendly way. So it's like, hey, be ready, you know? So I appreciate that you honor it and share in your Substack.
Yeah. Well, and one more plug related to that, especially for your listeners who may be facing those issues, or for oneself, because getting diagnosed with epilepsy at a young age helped me to realize, oh, I am not infallible.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, it takes us a little bit longer to realize that. But one of the features of my job is helping people to do advanced care planning. So I am always trying to remind people if they have not yet done an advance directive, like a healthcare proxy or a living yep. will, or just designating someone to make decisions for you medically when you cannot. That is so important. Doesn't even take over in most states. You can do it yourself, and you know, just have someone witness it. Don't even need a notary. And then having conversations with people about what you would want.
I think that's the most important part of it, is like mm-hmm. to think yeah. about it for yourself and to make sure that the people around you know. And in my family, there's a very clear divide of people who are okay having that conversation and people who avoid it like, you know, penicillin. So
yes, it's true in my family too. So
all right,
so I've tried.
This has been a delightful conversation. I love it. I'm going to move us towards wrapping it up. I want to give you a chance. So you're a hospital chaplain, and you also tell us you have a private practice. So take a second and tell us a little bit about what you do, and then you have an offer for the audience that I'll share.
Yeah. So actually, that was maybe another, you know, kind of turn in my journey during COVID and witnessing everything that was going on there in the hospital. I realized I miss having long-term relationships with people. When I'm working with people at end of life, you know, I'm always working with new families, and then I never get to see the rest of their story. So I started a private practice. I'm a spiritual director, which is someone that sits with people and helps them listen to the way that the spirit is moving in their life. A lot of that deconstruction from religion oftentimes comes into play. A lot of times people I'm working with are going through grief and how that's impacted their relationship with themselves, with others, or with the divine.
Very nice. All right. And so you have an offer for the audience, which is 5 simple spiritual practices that you can do today. And people can find that on your website, christinevdavies.com/gift. That link, you guys, is going to be in the audio show notes wherever you're listening, on YouTube, where you're watching the show. But the easiest way to get the links from the guests on the show is always to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email community, because then you can just click on it. I deliver it directly to your email box, and there it is for you. So I always put that plug in every single episode. Christine, are you ready to wrap this up with my final 3 questions?
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it. Share with us, if you will, if you order a pizza, what do you order? What is your perfect pizza topping combination?
I have to say mushrooms, and no one else in my family likes mushrooms, so I never get it. Although I have recently been turned on, I had never seen this, but living in Jersey, you know, we have a lot of pizza here. Recently, my son had penne vodka on the pizza, so it was
Really?
like noodles on top of pizza. That, I mean, double the carbs, but it was very tasty.
Very cool. All right, mushrooms on your pizza or penne vodka on your pizza. I have never seen that. I'm going to keep my eye out for it. All right, what is your favorite way to spend a rainy day?
Curled up in front of the fire with my Kindle and a big mug of tea, and maybe the rest of my family's allowed in there, maybe not, but just getting cozy and taking advantage of the fact that it's raining and I can't do any work on the hobby farm.
Love that. Absolutely. Forced rest. There you go. So you are a busy parent. What is something that you keep either in a bag you carry or in your car that saved you more than once? Saved in the context of like come in handy.
Let's see. I have lots of crayons and pencils in my bag, and lots of snacks. And so, even still, I'll use a purse I haven't used in years, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute, there's, you know, Ritz crackers in here. Who knows how old they are? So I think always having ways to distract my children, particularly if we were out somewhere or anticipating their needs and having that. And my car's a mess right now with all of their, you know, junk in there, but at least they can never say they're bored because they have about, you know, 15 books, lots of crayons, sketch pads, and water bottles.
And an endless supply of cheesy, salty crackers. That is the formula for occupying children in the car. It's still today and my whole life. Christine Davies, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Oh, it's such a joy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself. Head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.